It is the weekly news roundup, and a lot to get to this week. Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Coming up this hour, we'll be talking with two reporters from the Yale Daily News about the story that has outraged the country, the college admissions scandal. Also in the hour, we'll be hearing about the Connecticut Supreme Court decision regarding the Sandy Hook shooting lawsuit. And columnist Dan Haar will also be joining us. Dan took a heck of a road trip recently. He went to Massachusetts to do a bunch of things, but in particular, to buy some marijuana. Dan writes about budgets and money, so it was purely for academic reasons. And he's going to give us some interesting numbers about the economy and pot. But we're going to start our show today with WSHU's Charles Lane. Charles had a story the other day. You can find it at WSHU.org. It's about Riverhead. It's about flooding, persistence, and FEMA. Hi, Charles. It's nice to talk to you again.
Hey, Ron. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. To coin a phrase, let's begin at the beginning. Let's head out to Riverhead, go back in time, about 90, 100 years ago. What was going on back then?
Cauliflower and potatoes, from what I am told. Riverhead has always been a largely agricultural community. And potatoes and cauliflower. And starting in about 1920, we started to get what are called stagrants. They're sort of like migrant farm workers who just who stayed. They didn't leave. And some of those were African Americans coming up from Virginia.
Stagrants, how many?
Oh, I have no idea. Lots of them. I'm sorry, I have no idea. But it's safe to say that most of the East End was agricultural, and they needed farm workers to come in.
So they formed a community. They built houses, right? They got to know each other.
One in particular that I looked at was in Horton Avenue. Well, actually, I mean, there's several of these communities where we had migrant farm workers stay. Osborne Avenue, Horton Avenue, Doctor's Path. Those particular areas were populated by African-American farm workers.
Okay, so the stagrants stayed. They put down roots, particularly in this one area, Horton Avenue. And then what happened a few years ago?
It was particularly about the flood. There was a major, major flood in 2010 that turned Horton Avenue into a small lake.
And destroyed all the houses?
I mean, you can look at photographs. There were just 13 tiny homes sticking up out of this this vast body of water.
Okay, so now let's get to the crux of the matter. What happened to the homes? This is where the story gets interesting.
Well, the homes were, depending on who you ask, they were unlivable, and the people needed some way to someplace, but none of them, in fact, had flood insurance, and FEMA doesn't give assistance to communities this small. There was only 13 homes in on Horton Avenue, and so there's a dozen families who had no place to live and no money to buy a new place, and so they were scrambling to find a way to make themselves whole and to buy new houses. And what they ended up finding was a FEMA mitigation grant to buy out their homes and move someplace else.
But what does a mitigation grant do?
So FEMA has a pot of money that is specifically designed to mitigate future flood risks. So if there's a river that frequently floods, a town, a local jurisdiction can ask FEMA for money, and they can say, like, if we build a levee, if we buy out the houses and move, or if we do some other sort of flood mitigation project, we will ultimately save taxpayers money in the long run. And so they can put in a grant application, and FEMA will pay 75% of that grant application, and the town or the county or the local jurisdiction would then pay 25%. And there's really a few criteria that FEMA looks at, and they manage this money tightly, and they want to know if it's going to be cost effective. In other words, like if doing this project, say it's building a levee or buying out homes and moving people out of a flood zone, is it ultimately in the end going to save taxpayers money, and is it viable?
And how many years did it take for them once the process started and they started applying? How many years did it take before it actually paid off?
I don't know. I know when I talked to FEMA about this, they were very they saw the financial benefit to taxpayers in the project. I think their litmus was or not the litmus, but what they said, the taxpayers would save $1.40 for every dollar that was spent on the project within a 30-year time span. That's the model that FEMA applies. They take a 30-year window. They predict how much damage will occur if they don't do this project, how much the project costs, and if it pays off in 30 years, they go ahead and do it. And this one, in this Horton Avenue project, it ultimately was financially viable and would save taxpayers in the long run. But this was only, this is not quite 10 years ago. So we haven't, I don't think taxpayers have really seen a profit yet on that.
So we only have about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to bang out some questions here because I have many questions about this. What happened to the people who were living on Horton Avenue? Where are they now?
They moved. Horton Avenue is a very interesting place. It was a very tight community, and people had lived there their entire lives. Most of them ended up moving. One family moved to Mastic, another family moved to North Carolina, another family moved just to Doctor's Path on the other side of town. There was one particular gentleman who didn't move at all. He lived his entire life on Horton Avenue. And so when FEMA bought out his house, he just moved a couple doors up out of the flood range. But he was still adamant that he did not want to leave Horton Avenue.
I know some people like that. I understand that. I was born here, they say. I'm going to die here. This is it. This is where I spent my life, and nothing is going to make me move. When I think of this, and I know reading your story and listening to it, they basically beat the odds, right? When it came to getting FEMA assistance.
Yeah, and it most remarkable thing. So NPR did a story 2 weeks ago about where this money typically goes, and it typically goes to white wealthy homeowners or Americans. And this is not Horton Avenue at all. Horton Avenue is low wealth, entirely African American, and it was very, very unique that this community would. One, a community this small, and two, a community that was low wealth and African American would get this money. And I think in hindsight, when you look at it, it's just the sheer persistence of a couple of key individuals, a couple of community leaders, and the political connections that they had. They were able to get specifically former Congressman Tim Bishop to advocate for this grant on numerous occasions.
It sounds like it turned out well for them, but I wonder if they'll ever have that sense of community again, because that's such a rare commodity nowadays.
To be honest, I don't. It's the community, the way it was described to me. I don't see that replicated many other places in New York or elsewhere in the country. They used, I mean, Horton Avenue was the like a local a center for the entire black community on the East End. They would have Sunday barbecues, drag racing Fridays. There was a famous bar there. I mean, this was the place where the black community went on to almost every week, and it's at least my experience on Long Island. You don't typically find these communities that often, or at least you're finding them in decreasing frequency.
I know you spent a lot of time talking with Linda Hobson. She kind of ran the whole thing. What does she think about the community not being there and what they went through?
I suppose it's somewhat bittersweet in listening. So she organized the effort, and she was, and so I would assume that this would be something that she enjoyed and would want to do again. But she was at, she this was the most stressful period of her life, and she had to take a community that felt marginalized, that was mistrustful of government in general, and bring them into the fold. And she just described it as incredibly stressful. If it happened again, she would not volunteer to be the organizer anymore. It's just, and when we talk about bittersweet, I mean, one of the things that we talk about in politics all the time is self-advocacy, and this is an example of this. Like, these people are, by odds, weren't supposed to get a FEMA mitigation grant, but through self-advocacy they did. And what we heard at the end is, like, I wouldn't do it again, is what Linda Hobson said. So it talks a lot about how difficult it is to actually to lead a community, and how just frustrating and how burnt out you get at the end of it.
WSHU's Charles Lane. If you go to WSHU.org, or if you're listening there right now, move over to News Talk or some of the other features. You can find Charles's story. It's a great story. Listen to it, read it, and I think you'll enjoy it. Charles, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
No, thank you.
I'll speak with you soon.
Okay.
It is the Weekly News Roundup, and it's the full story. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is the full story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak, and it's our weekly news roundup. There was a lot of news this past week, and one of the big stories was the college admissions scandal. It's caused a lot of outrage. Yale University was featured prominently in many of the stories because its former women's soccer coach, Rudy Meredith, who resigned from his job last November, is reportedly getting ready to plead guilty to a number of charges. And now I just want to take a moment and tell you what the court documents say. It reads, beginning in or about 2015, Meredith agreed with William Singer and others known and unknown to the U.S. attorney to accept bribes in exchange for designating applicants to Yale as recruits for the Yale women's soccer team, and thereby facilitating their admission to the university in violation of the duty of honest services he owed to Yale as his employer. Yale spokesman Tom Conroy has said, as the indictment makes clear, the Department of Justice believes that Yale has been the victim of a crime perpetrated by its former women's soccer coach. The university has cooperated fully in the investigation and will continue to cooperate as the case moves forward. Let's get the perspective from two reporters at the Yale Daily News. They're Yale students, Bill Gallagher and Skakel McCooey. Bill Skakel, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Bill, I'm going to start with you. Were you surprised by the news? Some have said to me that this isn't news. They said this has been going on for years. Why is everyone shocked by this?
Well, I would say that it's not necessarily fair to talk about being surprised or not. We're here just to report on it. And what we can see is that the university didn't really know what was going on. So for many it's that I've talked to on campus, they were surprised. But I don't necessarily know if I'm free to comment myself on that.
Skakel, what's your perspective?
Sure. I mean, I think I'm in the same boat as Bill, that I'd prefer to speak just about kind of students' perspectives, but I can tell you just from kind of informal conversations with students and faculty that I've had since the news broke, that a lot of people are disheartened by kind of this this scandal, obviously. I think, there's a consensus that it's a lot of work to apply to Yale, and to get in is a big success. And to see that some people have paid to get into Yale, allegedly, is really disheartening for a lot of students.
And I think just to add quickly on that, most people that I've talked to, if not everyone, does believe in and wants a fair application system for everyone, I mean, regardless of economic background. So I think that on top of it, so that the game might be stacked against them, they feel that that is disheartening for sure.
So let me say that the reaction I have heard, and before I get into that, I just want to mention that both of you are traveling right now because Yale is on break. And so you've been talking with colleagues and friends and others by phone, Twitter, Skype, whatever. The reaction I've heard across the board on radio, TV, reading online, it's been astounding. People are angry. Why do you think the reaction has been? Why are they so angry about this? William?
Yeah, so I think I was watching a couple days ago Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo on CNN, and they were talking about how this is a larger question of privilege. Now, I'm not necessarily going to comment on whether I agree with that or not, but it certainly, it seems to have sparked a greater discussion about privilege in society and whether, you know, people deserve what they get in life, and whether we us as a society can actually make a difference and change that for the better. So I think from what I've seen around the news and what I've heard from other people is that, yeah, people are angry, they're angry because of perhaps we were living under a guise of something better. In reality, it's a little bit more sinister than that.
Skakel?
Yeah, and adding on to that, I think one of the, you know, just reading kind of social media responses by a lot of Yale students, a tweet by Alexis Ned, who's a reporter at Mashable, kind of struck a chord with a lot of students. And if it's okay, I can read the tweet. It's obviously
sure. Sure, please do.
The elite college admittance system is predicated on this completely legal ways rich people advantage their children via tutors, test prep, activities, sports, legacy, donations, time, and more. So it's extra funny to me when they fumble all that and say, F it, let's crime. And I think that's just kind of adding on to Bill's point about privilege. I think that, you know, is very kind of disheartening to people that a lot of people feel that the application system to a lot of elite colleges advantages the rich. You know, this is another example of that for a lot of people.
I have to say that I agree with both of you, because driving home from the station yesterday, I put on satellite radio and I was listening to, and I believe it was MSNBC, and one of the guests was saying people are angry because the schools mentioned in the indictment, and I was kind of jotting this down, I pulled off to the side of the road, the schools mentioned are elitist, and the people who want their kids to go there are elitist. Now, from my perspective, I've known a number of parents who have sent their kids to many good schools, and I don't think that the parents are elitist. Does it bother you when you hear this?
Again, I don't necessarily think we can comment on that, but it is obviously, I think, the people I've talked to at Yale, at least, they're not elitist, I think. And what I think every news station across the country has made this point that obviously, if you're a parent, you're gonna do whatever you can to get your kid as far ahead in life as possible. So, and I think Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo again say it best, in that they perhaps were misguided and then took that to the extreme. So perhaps they're not elitist, perhaps they are. I'm not going to comment on that. But again, it's all predicated on parents doing the best they can for their kids. And obviously, some parents can do more for their kids based on economic wealth and socioeconomic wealth than others.
Skakel?
Yeah, I think Bill's right not to comment on that. But kind of at least tangentially related, I think it's important to remember that schools like Yale, and we can speak more about Yale than we can about other schools, have made great strides to, you know, attract a very diverse community. Yale especially has made a huge effort to reach out to first-generation low-income students and try to get them to apply and tell them that Yale is a welcoming place for them. So again, won't comment on the elitist question, but I think you know, you should give credit where credit is due to Yale.
You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU. We're talking about the college admissions scandal. We're talking with two students at Yale University. They write for the Yale Daily News, Bill Gallagher and Skakel McCooey. You both had to go through the college application process. What do you think about that process?
I'm allowed to comment on that as a student, given that we're also breaking this story for the Yale Daily News. All I can say is that, at least for me, and I'm sure for Skakel as well, I applied normally and I got in. That's all I can say on the matter. I worked hard. That's about it.
You worked hard. You didn't have. Okay, Skakel.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, please.
you mean I've been covering admissions for Yale this past school year. I won't comment on my own admissions. Story. I agree with Bill that we applied and we got in, and we're very, very lucky to have done that. The thing that kind of strikes me about reporting on admissions is how complicated a system they have. Yale admissions receives, I think last year they received north of 37,000 applications.
I'm sorry. Give me that number again, because the connection broke up slightly.
Oh, I'm sorry. 37,000.
37,000 applications.
Right, which is a staggering amount of data to comb through, and I think Yale does a very as good a job as anyone in doing that. Yale focuses on a holistic review process, meaning that they take every part of an applicant's background into account, not just test scores. And I honestly think that's the right thing to do. And not to editorialize, I think many people agree. And a lot of experts agree that that's the right thing to do. I won't comment on my own admissions process, but I think Yale's admissions officers do a really great job, and are it's a very complicated system, but they handle it very well.
Skakel, since you've been covering the admissions process, I haven't had a chance to see your articles, and hopefully I'll get to them this weekend. I'm assuming that they're online. What is your reporting, your journalism found out? What can you share with us?
A few things. One, especially a few things that are related to this. Recently, we took a poll of Yale students on certain plus factors in admission. The plus factor is parts of an applicant's background or identity that would be helpful in creating a more diverse space in Yale's campus. So whether you play a sport, whether you play an instrument, where you're from, all sorts of factors. And we focused on two in particular, whether or not your parent was a current or potential donor, and whether you're a recruited athlete. And Yale's campus was pretty split on having recruited athlete status be a plus factor in admissions. 43% were for it, and 41% were against it. And then when you think about, or when we asked about potential or current donor status, only 22% of Yale's, of the students responding were for the idea that being a student or being a child of a potential or current donor should be a plus factor in admissions.
When did you conduct this poll? And how many students were part of the poll?
Sure, so it was, let me just get my article up. I think it was, we conducted in January, and we polled the entire Yale student body, but we had 1,400 respondents.
That's a nice number to get back.
Yes, absolutely.
Bill, were you part of that article or working on that?
No, so I covered the women's soccer team, and so I talked to Rudy Meredith personally twice a week. So we've sort of split it down the middle. Skakel's doing the admissions side, and given that the coach implicated for Yale is the women's soccer coach, the former women's soccer coach, head soccer coach, I'm doing that side, and we're just working together to try and get the full story on that. So, yeah.
When was the last time that you spoke with the coach or the former coach?
Just after his resignation in November, it was, I tried to get his comments on that, and he was saying that it was time to move on. After 24 years in charge, it was time for a change. He was looking forward to a new chapter in his life, and that he was looking forward for the soccer program to do the same. I tried reaching out to him a couple of days ago via the same channel. He did not respond, but yeah. So I've talked to him pretty often, at least last semester.
And so, also,
I'm sorry, Skate, go ahead.
When just going off of Bill's point there, and speaking about recent reporting that we've done, yesterday we released a story really explaining that Meredith was working as a cooperating witness since April 2018, meaning that for 7 months before his stepping down from head coach of Yale Women's Soccer, he was working as a cooperating witness for the FBI, meaning during an entire soccer season.
And a recruiting season is at that as well.
Did the administration know that between April and November, when he resigned, that he was working with the FBI?
So according to the information released by the DOJ, no, they did not.
Hey, Bill, since you obviously had a relationship with Rudy Meredith before that, did you, in your former reporting or when you knew him, was there any inkling that something like this was going to take place?
I've just based off of our calls, I would say no. There was nothing different to any other coach I've talked to. He commented on the games. I will say his quotes were a little bit more hard to understand, but I wouldn't put that down to anything. The team wasn't doing very well in general. In fact, they've only had one winning season over the last four seasons. So I don't think I it's fair to pin it down on anything. I don't think I could tell anything was up for sure.
As I mentioned before, both of you are traveling, so you're not on the campus. But when you're talking with fellow students, can you just give us a sense of the overall reaction? Are people upset? Are they angry? Are they disillusioned? Skakel, can I start with you, please?
Sure, absolutely. I think just before I answer that, it's really important to kind of place this in the context of this school year. This has been a school year where, admissions, especially at elite schools, has been challenged in a number of ways. Whether it's the DOJ investigation of Yale against alleged discrimination against Asian American applicants, which is ongoing, or the Harvard trial, on basically the same grounds, which is finished up and is still waiting for a decision, or the TM Landry scandal that happened, earlier this fall, I believe. This has been a year where admissions has kind of been in the forefront of a lot of students' minds. I think a lot of, to sum up a lot of the students' opinions, I think it's disappointed but not surprised, would be my kind of way of summing up. That people kind of unfortunately expect in some ways that if you have money, it may be easier to get into Yale, or you can kind of use it to get into Yale. And again, that's not my perspective. That's just what I'm hearing from students. But they're disappointed that's in their eyes a reality.
I think also just to add on to that, to those I've spoken to, it's using channels outside of the university. So using as what Singer uses the term side door entry. So that also is a massive disappointment for a lot of students that I've talked to. So I think that is something also very important to look at for sure.
I have 1 minute left and I know it's kind of coming from left field here, but just with the minute that we have left, is this the beginning of the end of the college admissions process as we know it? Will there be a sea change, or are we going to be talking a year from now and nothing will have changed? Skakel, what do you think?
I think that's a really hard question. I mean, I think, Yale's promised to take the necessary steps moving forward. Do I think there's a sea change? I honestly think that this kind of holistic review process And again, this is not my opinion, this is from experts, that this is the best way of conducting an application process. Potentially there may be kind of changes in how admissions handles certain aspects of it, but I would leave that up to admissions to suggest, I think.
Bill, I only have 10 seconds left, please.
Same as Skakel. I think Skakel put it very aptly there. I don't necessarily know if anything's going to change. But yeah, like everything I've read so far, this does seem like the best way to go about things in terms of applications and admissions.
Bill Gallagher, Skakel Makuei, reporters for the Yale Daily News. I look forward to reading your articles. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Full Story. We'll be back. We continue with the weekly news roundup on The Full Story, and let's talk about a story that broke just yesterday. In Connecticut, the state Supreme Court partially reversed a lower court ruling. That ruling by the lower court dismissed a lawsuit by the families of the victims of the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting against the gun manufacturer Remington. The gun that was used in the shooting, where 26 were killed, including 20 first graders, was made by Remington. Associated Press reporter Dave Collins is joining us. He's been covering the story for the AP. Dave, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
The case hinged around the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. Some people just refer to it as PLCAA. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, the 2005 federal law shields gun manufacturers from liability when they're products are used in crimes. And Remington has argued that, you know, this federal law, prohibits this lawsuit by the Sandy Hook families.
And so how did the attorneys for the family argue the case? How did they get around this, if you will?
They argue that Remington advertised the gun in a way that promoted violence, which they said was a violation of the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. And they said that's an exemption to the federal law.
How long has the Connecticut Act been in place?
I'm not sure how long. I think that dates back, I think, to the 1980s, and it was amended several times since then.
Was it amended in response to the shooting at Sandy Hook?
No, it's for very technical legal reasons regarding who can sue under the law.
So, as I understand it, the families can now get internal documents from Remington. Is that correct?
Well, first we're going to see if Remington's going to appeal the state Supreme Court ruling. I think there's an avenue for them to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review the decision. But if it does go back to the trial court and gets to the discovery phase, then they could see Remington's internal communications about how they marketed this semi-automatic rifle that was used in the school shooting.
So when you say it goes back to the trial court, that means going back to Bridgeport?
Yes, before Judge Bellis in Bridgeport.
Would they be able to get the internal documents before that trial ended, or would they have to wait till the end of that trial?
No, the discovery takes place before the trial, so both sides can go into the trial with the information they need to present their sides of the case.
So the ruling by the state Supreme Court yesterday was a narrow ruling, 4-3. Anything to be read into that?
Yeah, there was disagreement over how expansive the federal law is in shielding liability for gun makers. Chief Justice Richard Robinson wrote the dissenting opinion, and he agreed with Remington that the federal law, prohibits this lawsuit. And, even though it might not be a desirable you know, for all instances that, you know, you can't get around the federal law.
I was reading the comments from one of Remington's attorneys who said that the basically that there's no need, and I'm reading now from the copy, there's no need for a legal reexamination of the law. And he said, under the law, the manufacturer of the gun used by the criminal that day isn't responsible legally for his actions. Does that pretty much sum it up?
That sums up the dissent.
Their position, right?
Well, that's one of the many reasons for the dissent. And there's also efforts in Congress, Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut and others proposing legislation to get rid of the liability shield for gun manufacturers.
What was the reaction from the family members who were in attendance?
Oh, they were very pleased that they're going to get their day in court, and they want to, you know, see how Remington marketed this to the young people in their internal discussions and get to that information.
One of the things that I had, and I was trying to read so many of the different articles earlier today about what took place yesterday, I was having trouble figuring out what the families want to see happen. What do they want? What do they want to be the end game?
The primary thing they wanted was, you know, to not have these weapons be sold to the public. But the court ruling yesterday said, you know, mentioned or stated that the weapons are legal. And now I think they're trying to stop the marketing of these semiautomatic rifles that are popular in video games to young people, especially, and they don't want it marketed to troubled at-risk youth like Adam Lanza, the shooter in Newtown.
Obviously, Remington is now going to evaluate its position and decide its next step. Have you gotten reaction? Has there been reaction from other gun manufacturers?
I talked to the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is the gun industry lobby group that just happens to be based in Newtown. They were calling the Supreme Court ruling judicial overreach and a misinterpretation of the what's allowed under federal law. They represent the gun industry, and I tried to talk to Remington officials about the ruling, but they declined to comment, and their lawyers are not commenting either at this point.
How long has this lawsuit actually been going on for now?
I think it was filed in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. 2014, maybe.
So talking with all the legal people that you know, any sense of how much longer this is actually going to be in the judicial system?
Well, going back to court and going through all the discovery and all the pretrial proceedings, that could take months, maybe three years to get to trial. I've seen cases where it takes 5, 6, 7 years to get to trial. So it all depends also on if Remington appeals this to, you know, federal court, that'll add a whole new, you know, amount of time, months, year, you know, maybe a year to the process.
I read one article where one of the people being interviewed said, look, this pretty much is going to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. What's your feeling?
I think any decision, whether it's in favor of the Sandy Hook families or Remington, probably would be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I'm not sure how inclined they would be to take it.
Dave Collins from the Associated Press. Dave, thank you. We appreciate your time today.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. This is our weekly news roundup. A lot of news this week, just in the last few days. And one last topic to get to. And on the line with us is Dan Haar, who's columnist for Hearst Connecticut Newspapers. As you probably know, Connecticut and New York are both looking at legalizing marijuana. Just yesterday, Connecticut House Democrats came out with a proposal to legalize and tax marijuana, but they emphasized it's just the start of the discussion. Now, there are so many different aspects to this story. Well, some communities have the option to opt out. The opposition from some people for health and addiction reasons, the possible expungement of records for drug arrests, and of course, there's money. Connecticut needs money. Right now, Connecticut residents can go to Massachusetts, where pot is legal, and they can spend their money there. So Dan took a 2019 road trip. He went with the state representative, Josh Elliott, who's in favor of legalization, to explore the money aspect. Hi, Dan. How'd the trip go?
Good afternoon. We had a great time out there.
You had a great time. How much did you spend?
I think we spent a grand total of, I have to look it up in my notes, but I think it was about $300 on cannabis related products.
On cannabis and just to clarify,
the answer is $314.66 on cannabis related products, plus $62.93 in tax that went to both the state of Massachusetts and the town of Northampton and the town of East Hampton. They have a 3% municipal tax. But I want to be really clear from the outset that Representative Elliott and I disagree on this. He thinks that the potential for Connecticut to make money should not be a factor in the decision at all. I think it should. And that's where we differ. And so I want to not put words in his mouth. He does not think that the potential windfall for Connecticut, and as you know, law enforcement people think that by the time you do all the corollary costs related to addiction and other controls, that you don't make any money. So that's where we are.
I didn't know that the representative wanted the money aspect taken out of it. I've spoken with him in the past. I know that he is strongly in favor of it, but I don't remember him talking about that. So thank you for that.
Yes.
How much do you think Connecticut is losing or potentially going to lose if the state does not legalize and people simply go to Massachusetts to buy?
Well, the purpose of our trip was to illustrate not only that people are going to Massachusetts to buy, and thereby, you know, sending tax money to Massachusetts, and also not just tax money, but it's their economy. That is the people employed doing the growing, the delivering, the testing, all that stuff is in Massachusetts rather than in Connecticut. That's why we went to other places. We had lunch. We went to the casino. While we were there, I filled up my tank with gas 40 cents cheaper than Connecticut. I bought a bottle of alcohol to prove the point. I don't drink alcohol, but not much anyway. I got a lifetime supply if I got one bottle of scotch. But it's all to prove the point that other money gets spent when, as you obviously know, that's how economies work. You bring people in and they do things. So it's narrowly speaking, I'm on the more conservative end. I've heard people say Connecticut could be as much as, you know, $150 million. I think maybe half that. It's just a guess. Nobody really knows. But I would suggest maybe half that.
All right. So you're thinking that Connecticut will lose $75 million a year in taxes, in revenue generated, not just in taxes, but all the other aspects that come with it.
Well, when you add the other aspects, they may add up to much more than that. It depends how much people spend, right? And so that's, in other words, we spent on this trip, we spent $300, $400 or so, you know, total spend of $400. Right, it would have been a lot higher than that, but Josh Elliott is a professional poker player and won money at the casino. He won $103. So, you know, that subtracts from money that he spent. But the bottom line is that it's all part of commerce. And so I think it could be a lot more than 75, you know, maybe it could be double that. I don't know. Nobody knows what the numbers are going to look like.
I'm learning a lot of things today, Dan. And this the poker thing explains why Josh Elliott is a state representative. One of the reasons why.
Yeah, I lost $30 at the blackjack table. By the way, you may hear a ping in the background. I'm sitting in front of my laptop, and what popped up just now is pot stocks, 5 stocks you must own before more states legalize medical. And so you're starting to get this foment, this sort of popular effect of momentum, and that makes me skeptical because at some point things do reach a bubble, and we're certainly nowhere near saturation point for marijuana as a commercial entity. But I would worry that, like all good things, it can't just keep going up. And I would think about that, especially when you see clickbait, pot stocks you must buy. I would recommend people not rush into that.
So as someone who covers the economy, the state budget, who works the numbers, to you, it's simply a matter of good business. Look, you have to do it in Connecticut. Otherwise, you're just giving money to people out of state.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. The other part of it is that getting to Representative Elliott's position is that it isn't just and fair and right and logical to have a prohibition against marijuana when we don't have a prohibition against all these other things, alcohol and tobacco and so forth. So why have one and not the other? And the other side makes a very compelling argument that legalization does increase usage. And I mentioned that in the article. Josh and I had a conversation about it. You don't want to increase usage among underage people at all. You want any usage, and you don't want to increase usage among anybody. In other words, the idea is that Connecticut is now using X amount of pot, and so why not buy that in state rather than out of state? But to the extent that you're dramatically increasing the usage, it may or may not be a good thing. Generally, most research shows that in moderate, very moderate amounts, it's fine and there's nothing wrong with it, and it may have some potentially healthy medicinal effects. But in anything more than moderate, it's most definitely not a good thing.
Dan, what are the odds of passage in this legislative session?
I give it 90%. I think there's a lot of momentum. One of the issues is that there is, as my colleague Ken Dixon wrote in the story that was in today's papers, there are a lot of pieces to this, and one of them is racial equity. Marijuana arrests, as you know, have been disproportionate in inner cities and especially among African Americans. Same with incarceration. And there's an effort to expunge the records of people who had possession, not necessarily selling, but possession offenses. And if that doesn't happen, I don't think there's going to be a consensus, but that's very difficult to make happen because expungement is a technical, it's a difficult thing to do. It's not, at what point do you expunge, how far back, how big an offense, what if they're a corollary offense? There are a lot of questions. And so I think there's momentum on the side of doing this, but there are a lot of issues to get past.
Dan, I have about 45 seconds left. If it does pass and you think it's about 90%, when do you think Connecticut residents would be able to buy? Would it happen this year or next year, or would it take a while?
I believe 2 years. Massachusetts took 2 years, and they still didn't get it right because when they opened up, there were only two dispensaries and then quickly two more, and that's obviously not serving the market. You want to do something in between Massachusetts and Colorado. Colorado is a madhouse. Massachusetts is too restrictive. I give it about 2 years. Maybe I'll go down to 75% passage from 90. I think I may have overstated.
Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Newspapers. Dan, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for speaking with us, and I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Same to you. My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Dan. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Have a wonderful weekend. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.